and advance slowly. We must eliminate those scouts.
That sounds plausible, said Erin. But do we fight a holding action from now until the king dies of old age?
Somewhere there must be a conclusive encounter.
Indeed there must. And we must recognize the opportunity when it arises, answered Elladan. But until then, as the weaker side, we must hit and run, strike them where we can, make them think they are facing a force 10, 20 times greater than we are, and all the time we will be growing.
Chlor spoke.
There is something else to consider. Supplies. We have the forest and the deer and sheep are plentiful. The king has 10,000 men, and they will need to be supplied from the south. We must have a raiding force behind their lines. Empty bellies make for discontent.
I will lead that force, said Roem. It is my duchy, and I know all the roads. Give me 50 men, and we will live off the land and force them to send back troops.
You will be alone,
Lamfada pointed out.
We cannot support you.
Do not fear for me, Armorer. I am not ready to die yet. Very well, agreed Elladan. Select your 50 men and train them. You have 10 days.
What of the rest of us? Asked Mananan.
Your day is coming, said Lamfada, looking away.
Morrigan sat under the stars, her memories vivid and painful. Her love for Sameldanach seemed from another age, when the world was young and innocence a joy. Her 6 years in the city of the Vairi had drenched that innocence in blood and lust and depravity. She could no longer recall the numbers of men and women who had shared her bed, nor see all the faces. All she could remember clearly was the taste of the ambria and the surging strength it brought to her limbs. She had told Mananan that Sameldanach had tired of her, but it was not strictly true. Faced with the myriad pleasures of the Vairi, they had drifted apart, seeking new sensations, more pleasure and pain. Now Mananan claimed to love her. But he did not know. He loved the woman who once had been. She shivered as the night wind rolled down from the snow-covered peaks. The general had died swiftly, his body shriveling as his life filled her. He had not even known he was dying. She had left the empty hide-covered sack of bones where they fell. How soon would she need to feed again? A day? 2 days? She could hear Groundsel snoring by the fire. Detestable little man. You will be next, she promised herself. But then what? Mananan?
Chlor Givers?
Or merely another innocent stranger, like the man with the injured knee? Was life so enchanting that she could not bear to leave it? She knew the answer. Of course it was. To see and hear, to breathe and feel. How could anyone bear to die?
Can't you sleep?
Asked Groundsel, sitting up and running his fingers across his scalp.
Damned lice, he said. Nothing shifts them.
Try bathing once in a while.
What are you doing? He asked.
I'm thinking.
Do you never sleep? How do you manage to keep your strength?
I draw it from the company of men, Groundsel. Strangely, I'm feeling rather weak at the moment. He grinned at her.
That's the first time I've seen any sign of humour from you, Morrigan. Perhaps you're beginning to like me. Why don't we start afresh? Come and join me. I'll give you a little strength.
Beware, Groundsel. I might just do that.
He yawned and stood. She turned away as he urinated against a tree.
Who are we supposed to see? He asked.
The leader is a man called Bucklar. You should like him, Groundsel. He's built his kingdom the way you built yours, on blood and murder. I think that's why Elladan thought you were the man to accompany me. Do you think Bucklar will send men to aid Chlor's army?
That depends. If he feels threatened by the king, then he will. If he thinks he's safe, he'll wait. And when the other forest leaders send men, he'll attack their lands and extend his power.
It is doubly important, then, that he helps us. For without him, the other leaders will also hold back.
True, lady.
He began to climb into his leggings.
I thought you wanted me,
said Morrigan, rising and striding towards him.
I did, Groundsel said, grinning. But you didn't say please. Dawn's coming up. We should be moving.
Samuel Danach walked to the coffin and gazed down on the face of his oldest friend. His anger had gone, and he was aware of a terrible emptiness deep within him. He knew that he had loved Cairbre as a brother, but that had been so long ago, before the Crusade, before the Vairi, before the dawning of the New Age. Now he searched for that love and could find nothing. All he could see was a pale corpse, hands folded across a crimson breastplate. The other knights moved forward, circling the coffin and observing the body, and Samuel Danach looked from face to face. All wore the same expression. A shiver passed through the Lord Knight.
We all know, declared Samuel Danach, why our brother died. He had ceased to take the nourishment his body desired. He was physically weak. I do not know why Cairbre acted as he did, but it should be a lesson to us all. Our crusade is a holy one. We must restore the civilization and the power of the Gabala and introduce to it the wonders of the Vairi.
His words seemed hollow, and they echoed in the high-arched tomb. He saw again Manannan riding onto the field, his silver armor ablaze.
They had been friends. Friends. The concepts of friendship, of love, of brotherhood moved in his mind like wisps of smoke, close, but unobtainable.
Are you well, Samuel Danach? Edwin asked.
Yes. I feel there should be words to say over our friend, but I can think of none.
Then let us cover him and be gone, said Bursis. This place is cold and inhospitable.
Yes, whispered Samuel Danach. Cover him. He turned and strode for the stairs. The tallest of the knights, he was wide-shouldered and narrow-hipped, and his movements, even in armor, were smooth and sure. He led the knights to the upper room, where they seated themselves around the oval oak table.
It is time, said Samuel Danach, to gauge the strength of the enemy. The boy sorcerer has placed a barrier around the forest, and now is the moment to breach it. Give of your strength, my friends.
The knights bowed their heads, and Samuel Danach felt the power soaking into his frame. Standing, he moved away from the table, lifting his arms. He called for the red. His right hand sliced through the air, which parted like a torn silk screen. A cold breeze whispered into the room. Samuel Danach opened the curtain further and gazed on the night-shrouded forest of the ocean. Then he stepped through and sealed the opening behind him. He was in a glade by a rushing river. Silently, he made his way to the nearest hilltop and gazed around him at the moonlit landscape. A mile to the north lay the village of Clor Givis. Samuel Danach sat cross-legged on the grass and closed his eyes, his spirit soaring into the night sky. Picturing the silver armor of the Gabala knights, he felt the pull of their magic. He found himself floating by a cave. Inside, a fire was burning low, and he could see seven sleeping figures. He recognized the Duke of Mactha and Manannan, the others he did not know. He left the scene and rose once more. This time the pull took him far to the west, and he came to a long hall wherein stood a shining figure surrounded by scores of warriors. The knight
was telling the men of past glories and great heroes. His voice was compelling, and Samuel Danach could see the colours blossoming throughout the hall. This one was a danger. Rising again, he journeyed east and north. Here in a hollow he found Morrigan and a squat, ugly peasant. Samuel Danach recoiled from the man. This was the enemy, he thought. This was the kind of man who now wore the silver. Anger flared in him. His spirit eyes turned to Morrigan, whose beauty in the moonlight was beyond reason. He smiled as she made some cutting remark to the peasant. How could she be here, among these low-born outlaws? For some time, Samuel Danach roamed the forest, seeking signs of the rebel army. Nowhere could he find any evidence of large concentrations of troops. But he did not have time to search the entire forest and return to the cave. There he hovered at the entrance and fixed his concentration on the blonde youth who slept beside three golden statues of hounds. Come to me, he said softly. Rise and come to me. Lamfada stirred and rolled over. A shimmering light glowed around him, and his spirit rose from his body. He blinked and saw Samuel Danach. The knight moved back into the moonlight. Lamfada followed, and they floated high above the trees.
How did you come here?
Asked the youth. How did you think to stop me? Replied Samuel Danach. Foolish child, it is time to die. Suddenly Samuel Danach's form swelled to dwarf the terrified Lamfada. Talons erupted from the knight's fingers and slashed at the boy's chest. He hurled himself back and reached in terror for the gold, but his mind was too full of fear and panic, and it eluded him. He tried to escape, but Samuel Danach's giant hand circled him, and he was drawn ever closer to the huge face. I expected at least a battle, child, said the knight. And you shall have one, came a voice from behind. Samuel Danach swung to see a familiar figure floating beside him. Olafair, what a pleasant surprise. Not for me. Release the boy. Why should I? A dead man cannot harm me. Indeed, he cannot. But there is a live man standing beside your body, with a knife to its throat. The figure faded from sight, and Samuel Danach smiled. Well, boy, it seems you are to live for now. He released Lamfada and sped away. Samuel Danach opened his eyes and rolled to his right, his dagger hissing from its scabbard. There was no one close, but beside his body were the marks of recent footprints. You should have killed me, Olafair, as I killed you. He opened the curtain of night and stepped back into the upper room. Once seated at the table, he roused the knights. Swiftly, he outlined all he had seen. Then he turned to Edrin and Bursis. I see no real danger to the king's army, said Samuel Danach. But there are two men who should be dealt with at haste. Edrin, you and Bursis will go to Pertia Port. There you will show the commander the king's seal. Bursis will take command of 500 men and lead an attack on the citadel above the Bridge of Chains. Morrigan will be there. I do not want her harmed, but there is one with her who offends me. Kill him. You, Edrin, will take 50 men and move through to the west of the forest. Find a village nestling below the two highest peaks. There you will hear of one of these new knights. He is a storyteller of great power, and, given time, he could raise a force against us. Destroy him. Use any means. You understand? I will not fail you, Samuel Danach. Be assured, he will die. Lamphada watched the red knight disappear into the distance.
Ruad,
whispered the youth. Are you still here?
He never was here, came a voice in his mind. Return to your body. I will come to you within a short time.
Lamphada did as he was bid. Then he stood, wrapped a blanket around his shoulders, and silently moved past the sleeping knights. Outside the cave, he sat on a rock and scanned the countryside. After a few minutes, he saw a tall figure making his way up the rocky path. Dressed in long robes of faded blue and ancient leather sandals, the man was old and completely bald. A forked white beard flowed to his chest, and he was using a quarterstaff to aid him on his climb. The newcomer halted before Lamphada.
I am the Dagda, he said, and you were born under lucky omens.
Thank you for your help. Why did you impersonate Ruad?
The Dagda shrugged.
It was a necessary deceit, which sowed the seed of fear in Samaldanak's mind. Also, he continued, sitting beside the youth, I knew Ruad Rofessa, and I think my deceit would have pleased him. How are you faring, Lamphada?
The armorer shrugged.
I do my best. I can do no more, but I wish Ruad was here to guide me.
That is understandable. But a man is strongest when he is alone. Remember that. You have the knights, and I think the source is with you. Even so, there is much you must suffer.
I know all this. When I found the gold, I saw all that could be, all that should be, all that might be. What I could not discern was all that will be. Good men will die, I know that.
All men die, good or otherwise, said the Dagda. And I know what you saw. I was with you when you flew.
You were the one whose presence I felt. I hoped it was Ruad.
Do not be disappointed. I have waited for you for a very long time.
The Dagda chuckled.
Precisely. 142 years. Does that seem a long time to you, child? I can see that it does. Well, we are here now, and you have much to learn.
What do you mean? Waited for me?
You, or one like you. Ruad would have told you had he lived. You walk the gold, Lamphada, and that is rare. It is special. All the colors are subject to the gold, and it is part of the great harmony that when the colors are threatened, the gold shines. The red is swelling over the realm, but its users do not understand the harmony. They seek to make the red preeminent, but no color exists of itself. If the red is allowed to dominate, the other colors will fade and die. Neither can the red exist alone. So then, those who seek to promote the red are actually destroying all magic. And without magic, the world would have only one color. It would be gray. The gray of the tombstone. The gray of ashes. You understand?
No, said Lamphada. Magic is used by very few. How would the world be harmed if it failed? Trees would still grow, flowers would bloom, babies would still be born.
No, that is not the case. All life is magic, and all men feel it. They see the spectacle of the dawn, and they are filled with a sense of wonder. That is magic. See the look in the mother's eyes as she holds her firstborn and cuts its cord. She understands magic. In that moment, for that precious second, she understands. But when the harmony is disrupted, as now in the realm, and the magic is under threat, there is only cynicism and despair.
and man's more brutal emotions begin to surface. No, my friend, the world needs magic as it needs air and water.
Who are you, Dagda? What are you?
Lamfada asked.
Are you some sort of god?
The old man shook his head.
I am a man. No more, no less.
A long time ago I was, in the world's eyes, a great man. But I forsook my life and its riches, for I yearned to know all the world's secrets. I came to this forest and met a man who had waited for me for 87 years. He was the Dactyl, and though his story was different from mine, as indeed yours will be, we were the same. We were rings in a chain that began when man first reared to his hind legs, and will end when the stars fall and the sun dies. And perhaps not even then.
Lamfada's mouth was dry, and he wished to be free of this strange old man. As if sensing his fear, the Dagda placed a bony hand upon his shoulder.
We, he and I, you and I, are the enchanters. We watch the colors and we nurse them. We walk the land and we maintain the balance. Where all is war and plague and death, we seek to aid the white or the green or the blue. Where all is peace and tranquility, we strengthen the red and the black. But mostly, we guard the yellow. For as you now know, Lamfada, the yellow is merely the gold disguised, and it is the gold that maintains the other colors.
Why is this not known?
Lamfada asked him.
Once it was, boy, and through such knowledge, men made themselves gods and brought calamity upon themselves. Now it survives in folk tales and legend. The sun worshippers echo the mystery. They worship the sphere of gold that feeds the earth. Think of it. All that grows or lives or breathes depends upon the sun. And that is so with the colors. The yellow is born of innocence and the laughter of children, fed by the sense of wonder in the young. In its turn, it nourishes the others. But now the truth has become a mystery, for it is safer that way. I guard that mystery. Now you will guard it.
What do you require of me?
I require nothing. I have completed my task, as the guardian before me completed his. He was the Dagda. Now you are the Dagda.
I do not wish to be.
No more did I. It is lonely, Lamfada, and yet it is fulfilling. You will find it so.
And what if I die? Do you tell me the world will end? I do not believe it.
If you die, another will be chosen, and you are only one of many. But you will not die yet. You did not see your own death in any of the futures, only the deaths of your knights. I know, for I too have seen the futures. I will leave you now. You will need time to think.
When will you come back for my answer?
The old man smiled.
I will not come back. I have done all that I was required to do. Now I will find a place. I will watch the stars, and I will die at peace and join the colors.
The Dagda pushed himself to his feet and looked into Lamfada's eyes.
You have changed, young man, since I first saw you on that hillside 6 years ago, when you watched the Gabala knights ride to a doom they did not deserve. And you will change even more through the long, lonely years ahead. Count the days, and the months, and the years. And one day, you will look into the face of a newcomer, and you will see what I see. Farewell.
I don't want it. You cannot do this to me,
shouted Lamfada, storming to his feet. But the old man ignored him. He had heard those same words before. 142 years, 3 months, and 8 days before. But then, it was he who had spoken them. Chapter 19. Groundsel reined in his stallion at the top of the rise, and gazed down in silent wonder at the bridge of chains spanning the chasm. The bridge was constructed of huge rings of iron from which hung rods connected to more rings. To these were fastened wooden planks. The swaying structure began on the northern slopes of a wooded hill and stretched for almost a quarter of a mile to where it joined a stone promontory set beneath a portcullis gate.
"How did they make it?"
asked Groundsel, as Morrigan rode alongside him.
"Some believe it was magic," she told him, "but my father explained that they first made a simple rope bridge and gradually strengthened it. He said it took over 7 years to construct."
Groundsel switched his attention to the citadel itself. It was carved from the side of the mountain and reared above the chasm like a giant tooth. As far as he could see, the citadel was inaccessible from the south or west. Only the slender bridge linked it to the forest. The fortress was walled to the north and boasted 2 square towers above the portcullis. Groundsel could see no sentries, nor movement of any kind on the walls.
"I do not like the thought of riding a horse across that bridge," he said. "I've never liked heights."
"You will find it will support you well enough," she told him, edging her mount forward.
Together they rode down the hill and halted before the bridge, where Morrigan lifted her helm from her head and placed it over the pommel of her saddle.
"Are you ready, Forest Lord?" she asked, grinning.
Groundsel's face was pale, his mouth set in a hard line. He did not answer, but spurred the stallion forward. As the horse moved out onto the bridge, he pulled down the visor of his helm and shut his eyes. Morrigan followed him, riding close to the right-hand side of the structure and gazing down over the iron rings. The chasm was deep, and she could just make out the bright ribbon of a stream running over the rocks below. She transferred her gaze to Groundsel, who was sitting like a statue, looking neither left nor right. The horse's hooves sounded like slow drumbeats on the wooden planks.
"Enjoying the view, Groundsel?" she called.
But there was no reply. Smiling, she kicked her horse into a run. The bridge swayed alarmingly as Morrigan overtook Groundsel and cantered up to the portcullis gate, where she swung her mount and waited while her companion made his slow way forward. Once on solid ground, Groundsel slid from the saddle and sat down beside the gate. He removed his helmet and wiped the sweat from his face.
"You do not look well, my lord," she said.
His muttered reply was short and brutal. Laughter burst from Morrigan.
"My dear Groundsel, how could he use such language in front of a lady? A knight of the Gabala should always be courteous. Shall we go inside?"
Groundsel stood and led his horse through the gateway. As they passed under the portcullis, he stopped and looked up.
"Rust is solid," he said. "What sort of fool allows his defences to fall into such disrepair?"
"I don't know," she replied sweetly. "Perhaps the man is a peasant. He probably doesn't understand knightly ways. You could instruct him, Groundsel."
His eyes were cold as he approached her.
You seem intent on making me angry, bitch. That is not wise.
Have I offended you? Oh, I am sorry, dear Groundsel. Perhaps we should kiss and become friends again.
I would sooner kiss the rear end of my horse, he snapped.
Well, your experience is obviously greater than mine in such matters, but I pity the horse.
She dragged on her reins and cantered into the citadel. Nothing moved. The fortress seemed deserted. She headed her mount towards the high keep and halted before the steps to the double doors. Groundsel rode alongside her.
There's nobody here, he said. What in hell's name happened?
They are inside, she told him.
How do you know?
Morrigan shook her head and dismounted, wondering how he would react if she told him she could sense their blood, warm and promising. Mounting the steps, she banged her mailed fist against the door.
Buckler!
She called.
You have visitors!
The left-hand door slid open, creaking on its hinges.
Don't go in!
Called Groundsel, dragging his long sword clear.
I don't like this at all.
Then stay outside, she advised.
She stepped into the cool interior and smiled at the woman who stood holding the bent bow, the arrow aimed at Morrigan's face.
Do not fear me, she said. I am here with a message from Chlor Givus.
Behind the woman were several children, one of whom held a curved dagger. Movement came from the shadows to left and right, and Morrigan swung her head. There were some 20 women in the hall. Their eyes were frightened, their manner tense and expectant. Then Groundsel entered, grinned and sheathed his blade.
Wonderful, he said. We've ridden for days to find a fortress of women and children. How many will want to join Chlor's army, do you think?
Who are you?
Asked the woman with the bow, easing the string forward and lowering her weapon. Morrigan noted that the arrow was still notched, and could be loosed in an instant.
I am Morrigan. The ape in the armor is Groundsel. We are looking for Buckler. The king's army is about to attack us in the south, and we were hoping Buckler could send some men to aid us.
No, the woman said. He won't do that. He can't. We are already under attack. A force has invaded the forest from Pertia Port and wiped out two settlements. My husband and almost all of the men have gone after them.
What a genius, said Groundsel.
Leaving his home base undefended. Come on, Morrigan, let's go.
You leave if you wish, said Morrigan. But I've had enough of sleeping on the ground, with ants crawling inside my armor. I intend to stay here the night, and take a bath.
Groundsel approached her.
I may not be a knight by birth, Morrigan, but neither was I born a fool. This is not a fortress, it's a tomb. There's only one way out, over that bridge, and if the enemy gets here before Buckler returns, everyone here will be slaughtered. Is a bath worth the risk?
You worry too much, she told him.
Your insults are easier to bear than your stupidity, he retorted, and turning on his heel, he strode from the hall and mounted his stallion.
His helm was hanging from the pommel, and he eased it into place.
What a useless mission, he thought, as he rode from the portcullis gate.
4 days in the company of a harridan, and nothing to show for it. He swallowed hard as his horse walked out onto the gently swaying bridge and steeled himself to stare straight ahead. The boards beneath the horse creaked and groaned, the chains to the left and right of him grating. Safely on the other side, he angled his white stallion up the hill and into the trees, halting to stare back at the citadel. Morrigan was right, he knew.
He was a peasant, and worse, he was a murderer and a thief. How amusing he must seem to her and the other patricians. A movement came on the hillside opposite, and he saw a young boy walk out of the undergrowth with a small grey dog beside him. Now that was a good age to be, thought Groundsel, remembering the early years of his youth, when he had played with the master's hounds, and all the summers were lifetime long and golden, and the winters bright with cold magic. He grinned, thinking of the golden-haired child he had saved from the snow. It would be nice to watch her grow in Severon, to see her dance and sing and play. Why waste time on this doomed war? Morrigan's words lashed at him. The ape in the armor is Groundsel. A month ago he would have killed her for those words, and thought nothing of it. Suddenly, the boy darted down the hillside and raced onto the bridge, the dog running beside him. Groundsel swung in the saddle. Back along the road were some 30 soldiers, marching two abreast towards the citadel. Groundsel chuckled.
"Have a good bath, Morrigan, my sweet," he whispered.
He could see movement on the walls of the citadel. Several women were gathering at the gate towers, armed with bows and quivers of arrows. The soldiers marched to the bridge and halted. Loosening their packs, they dropped them at the roadside and untied the small round shields that were buckled to them. Finally, the officer gathered his men around him, giving instructions.
"Be interested to see how you're going to handle this, Morrigan," murmured Groundsel.
The soldiers surged onto the bridge and ran forward, holding their shields before them. Groundsel could see that the few archers on the battlements would not stop them. Sunlight sparkled from Morrigan's silver armor as she stepped into sight, sword in hand.
"You've got pluck at least," owned Groundsel.
Seeing her before them, the soldiers slowed their charge. Arrows thudded into their shields or bounced from breastplates and helms. One man went down with a shaft in his thigh, but the rest ran on. Morrigan sprang to meet them, her longsword slicing murderously through a wooden shield and half-severing the arm beneath. The warrior screamed and hurled himself away from the silver figure, tripping to fall in front of his comrades. Several men tumbled over him, and the charge faltered. Morrigan's sword rose and fell in the melee, cutting through armor, skin, and bone. Several blades bounced from her own armor, but no blade touched her flesh. Five men were down before the attackers regained their composure, and Morrigan was forced back, step by step, towards the wider portcullis gate, where they could get behind her and bear her down. Groundsel decided to watch until she was overpowered. The sound of advancing hoofbeats came to him. Back along the road was a rider in crimson armor. Groundsel's eyes narrowed.
"Poor Morrigan," he thought,
and was about to swing his horse and ride away when a series of images flashed into his mind. The child on the hillside, Morrigan in her silver armor, her white horse behind her in the gateway, and now the Red Knight. The words of the dagger cut into him like hot knives.
"He too will die in the spring. I see a horse, a white horse, and a rider in shining silver, and a child on a hillside. The demons are gathering, and a great storm will descend on the forest. But Groundsel will not see it." This was the day then, and the rider would kill him. "Don't be a fool," he told himself. "You are clear. The dagger is wrong. Ride away and cheat your fate."
But then he recalled the look in Manannan's eyes, and the promise he had asked of all the knights.
"Damn you all!" shouted Groundsel.
Slapping the stallion's rump, he galloped down the hill.
The stallion thundered onto the bridge and raced at the startled soldiers. Groundsel's sword hacked down at the first to come within range, and then he was among them, cutting left and right. Morrigan, blood flowing from a wound in her temple, where her helm had been dashed from her head, forced her way into the fray, swinging her sword double-handed. In the confined space, the soldiers found it difficult to hit out for fear of injuring their fellows, but Groundsel and Morrigan were in no way so impaired. Groundsel's blade crashed through the officer's helm, dashing his brains to the wooden boards.
"Back!"
yelled one of the soldiers, and they fled. Groundsel stepped from the saddle and looked around him. 12 soldiers were down. 3 were still alive, but bleeding heavily. He killed them.
"We are dead," said Morrigan, her voice flat and cold.
Groundsel glanced back to see the Red Knight riding slowly across the Bridge of Chains, a dark sword in his mailed fist.
"Speak for yourself," returned the former outlaw. "I never met the man I couldn't kill."
Morrigan said nothing, but she backed away, her sword falling from her hand. The Red Knight advanced with terrifying lack of speed, the undead stallion plodding forward. Groundsel rode to meet him, halting his mount in the knight's path. A dry, metallic chuckle came from within the red helm.
"It takes more than armor to make a warrior, knight," said a voice. "I shall kill you slowly for your effrontery. I shall dismember you." "You want to talk first, don't ya?" hissed Groundsel. "Well, I've heard your boasts, scumbucket. Now let's see how you fight."
He spurred his stallion and aimed a wicked blow at the crimson helm, but the Red Knight swayed in the saddle, and Groundsel's sword swept harmlessly by. A thundering cut hammered into Groundsel's neck plates. Stars exploded before his eyes, and he tried to crash his own blade at the crimson figure. But again and again, the dark sword clanged against the Gabala armor. His shoulder plate was ripped from him, then his helm was struck, the visor spinning away. His stallion reared, saving Groundsel from a thrust that would have speared his eye. The horse backed away, and Groundsel dragged in a shuddering breath. The Red Knight advanced, and in that moment Groundsel knew the end had come. He could not lay a sword on the man. The Red Knight began to laugh.
"What a sorry day for the Gabala. You really are the worst knight in history. I hope there are others better than you. And now, peasant, it is time to send you to hell."
Groundsel said nothing, but as the Red Knight moved in, he kicked his feet from the stirrups and dived at him. It was the one move Bursis had not anticipated. With lightning reflexes, the Red Knight swung his sword to slice deep into Groundsel's shoulder, smashing through the collarbone and down deep into the lungs. Ignoring the pain, Groundsel's powerful arms circled the knight, driving him from the saddle. They landed across the huge rings that held the bridge and swayed there for a second. Groundsel's face was pressed close to the Red Knight's helm, and the former outlaw could see the fear in his enemy's eyes.
"Not talking now, are you, pig breath?"
he spat, blood bubbling down his beard.
"Send me to hell, will ya? Well, you can join me on a journey."
"No!"
screamed Bursis. But Groundsel, with the last of his strength, dragged his opponent over the edge, and the two figures toppled out into space. Morrigan ran to the precipice and stared down. The red and silver figures were still locked in a deadly embrace, but now they looked like children's toys sparkling in the sunlight. Smaller and smaller they became, until at last they were dashed against the jagged rocks below. At the moment of impact, Morrigan averted her eyes. The undead stallion fell to the boards, its flesh stripping away, and a terrible stench was borne to Morrigan on the breeze. At the far end of the bridge, the soldiers were gathering for another rush. But suddenly a horn sounded, and the hillside was alive with forest men who charged into the startled troops. Morrigan did not watch the slaughter. She moved to the edge of the chasm and looked down at the tiny figures.
"You were a man, Groundsel," she said.
Shearer watched as the Duke of Macfer led his 50 riders from the village. For 10 days she had observed their training, or joined with other groups practicing archery or sword work. Of Erin she had seen little, and her patience was wearing thin. She had spurned the safety of Cithaeron in order to avenge her sister's death, but now she felt useless, and worse, ignored. She had seen Clor Givis walking the hills with Arion, but only twice had Erin sought her out. Once to see that she was comfortably ensconced in a primitive cabin, and a second time when she received a nick in her upper arm after an overenthusiastic practice session with longswords.
"Why must you put yourself in danger?"
he had asked her as he examined the shallow cut.
"What sort of question is that?" she responded. "Am I not also a part of Hlor's army?"
"You are a woman," he stated, as if that answered the question.
"Is Morrigan not a woman, or Arion?"
"That is different. Morrigan is strange. Arion has been raised in the forest. Anyway, I have no say over the others."
"You have no say over me," she stormed. "The only connection we have is that you killed my sister."
Now he avoided her completely, which was galling. Several of the forest men had approached her, but these she sent packing with strong words. She had asked the Duke of Macfer if she could ride with him and raid the supply lines, but he had politely refused her request. He had dismounted from the grey stallion and placed his hand on her shoulders. "I say this to you in confidence," he whispered. "We will not be coming back. There is no hope that we can evade pursuit for long. Most of the men with me understand this. I do not want to see you in peril, Shearer. It was bad enough being part of your sister's trial. You understand?"
"You are going out to die."
"I think so, though I will strive to delay the dreadful day." Now he was gone, as Clor, Elladan, and Manannan were gone. The king's army had reached the southern border, and most of the knights had travelled south to prepare the defences and ready the men. Already word had come back that Elladan had ambushed some of the king's scouts and destroyed them in a short battle. Of Manannan and Clor there was no word. Shearer joined a group of women for the midday meal of venison and dried fruit, then took her bow and quiver and wandered to the hills. It was she who first glimpsed Morrigan riding slowly along a game trail, followed by scores of warriors. She ran down to meet them.
"Where is Groundsel?"
she called out to the silver rider. "Dead," answered Morrigan, touching spurs to her mount and riding on. Shearer joined the column as it wound its way down to the settlement. There were more than 250 men, and she soon gathered that they were from a citadel to the north. They had already fought one battle, routing troops from Pertia Port, and now were pledged to Glor Givis. It seemed that Groundsel and Morrigan had saved many of their wives and children, and the leader, Bucklar, had promised to aid the rebellion. Shearer sat with the citadel men as Bucklar, Erin, and Amfada discussed strategy in the cave. Towards dusk, the citadel leader, a tall, stout warrior with greying hair and a trident beard, led his men south. Shearer gathered her bow and joined them. Nuada awoke to the sound of birdsong. Opening his eyes, he saw the dawn breaking over the mountains, The sky ablaze with color, pink banners streaming into the virgin blue, white clouds running before the sun, like sheep before a golden lion. Cartier's head was resting on his shoulder, her arm draped across his chest. He snuggled down into the blanket, feeling the warmth of her body against him. This was contentment. This was joy. Far from the front line of battle, an eternity away from the killing and slaying, Nuada was at peace. Cartier mumbled something in her sleep and Nuada's hand slid over her hips. Her eyes opened.
"Dawn already,"
she whispered.
"It is a beautiful day," he told her. "A veritable prince of days."
Pulling her to him, he kissed her softly. For an hour they made love without haste, then lay together in comfortable silence. Finally, Nuada stretched and sat up. The fire was dead, and Brion was nowhere to be seen. Usually at this time he would be broiling rabbit meat for their breakfast, or pigeon, or lamb. Nuada rose and strolled to the waterfall, wading in to stand beneath the showering water. It was cool, and wondrously refreshing. Sunlight bathed the pool at the fall's base, and rainbows danced through the curtain of water. Paradise could not contain more beauty, Nuada thought, as he toweled himself down with his shirt. Cartier moved to a tall rock and dived into the pool. Nuada envied her the ability to swim. It was something he would have to learn. As he sat back and watched her glide through the water, his thoughts moved to his mission. So far, they had visited a dozen villages, and at each settlement his words had inspired a following. More than 300 men had pledged themselves to the cause, but it should have been more, many more. He must have spoken to more than 2,000 warriors, he reflected, glancing back at the armor laid on a blanket beneath an overhanging pine. The knight without a sword. He felt a pang of guilt. Not because he did not fight, but because he was so glad that he did not. It made him feel like a hypocrite. "Go out and join Clore, all you young men, but not me. No, I'm a poet, you see. I just fill your heads with glory and skim past the maggots and the worms and the pain."
He had tried to paint a picture of the war as a holy cause, good versus evil, light against dark. But here in the forest, all was shade. "Nuada! Nuada!" called Brion. Nuada rose and saw the burly blonde forester running towards the pool.
"What is the matter?"
he asked, climbing down from his rock to meet the running man.
"The king's men have surrounded the village. They have herded all the people into the hall."
"Slow down. Tell me all."
"I went back just before dawn. I couldn't catch anything for breakfast, so I thought they would let us have some food. When I got close, I saw the horses, so I hid. They gathered in Ramoth and all his people. I don't know what they plan, but we must get away from here. We're too close."
"Why so frightened? We have horses. We can outrun them, surely."
"There is a red knight with them, and they have dark magic. You have said this many times, that they are the evil ones. We must get away."
"A red knight? Here? Why?"
"I don't know," said Brion. "I'll saddle the horses."
Cartier swam to the shore and rose from the water.
"What is for breakfast, Sir Knight?"
she asked.
"Nothing, I'm afraid. We have to leave. Ramoth's village was attacked this morning. It is not safe here."
"Poor Ramoth," she said. "I really liked him."
"So did I. Now get your things together."
They gathered their packs and tied them to the saddles. Nuada climbed into his armor, which Brion helped him to buckle. A man stepped into the clearing, and Brion's dagger flashed out.
"Ramoth," greeted Nuada, grinning. "You escaped. Well done."
The newcomer was tall and lean,
dressed in dark skins of polished leather. He approached Nuada and bowed.
I did not escape, sir. They let me go.
Rama swallowed hard and looked away.
It is you they want. I must return with you within the hour, or all my people die.
The Red Knight, Sir Edrin, has promised that we will be freed the moment you surrender yourself.
You can't, cried Cartier. They will kill you.
She swung on Ramath.
How dare you come here and ask this of him? How dare you?
Nuada pulled her back.
How
can you be sure he will keep his word, Ramath? He asked.
I cannot be, sir. But what else can I do?
Nuada's mouth was dry. He lifted a canteen from his saddle and drank deeply.
I have a mission, you see, he said at last. I must raise an army to fight these evil men. You understand? I cannot...
His voice faded to silence as he saw the look of despair on Ramath's eyes.
I have three sons, sir. None has yet reached 5 years. They are sitting with their mother, waiting for the knives to open their throats.
Nuada turned away.
Don't listen to him, Cardia pleaded. Please, Nuada, think of us. Think.
Nuada stooped and lifted his helm, handing it to Brion.
Keep this. I will not need it.
Take Cartier back to Hlor and the others. Tell them I'm sorry. I don't have the strength to refuse. Cartier grabbed at his arm.
They'll kill you,
she said, tears spilling to her cheeks.
Sweet heaven, they'll kill you.
He drew her away from the others, his vision misting as he kissed her.
I love you, he said, and I think that this morning's joy was a gift, a last gift. I never saw a dawn like it.
He pulled her close.
I don't know what to say. There are no words, Cartier. Let me come with you, please.
No, go with Brion. I will feel stronger if I'm alone.
He strode to his horse and mounted. Then, taking a deep, shuddering breath, he touched his spurs to the stallion. Cartier ran forward, but Brion pulled her away as Nuada rode from the glade, not daring to look back. Ramath walked beside him in silence until they reached the last hill. Then he reached up and touched Nuada's hand.
I will never be able to thank you enough, said the leader.
Nuada smiled, but his mouth was too dry for words, and he was trembling. As he guided the horse down into the village, soldiers ran out, ringing him with their lances. He was ordered to dismount and did so. His limbs were shaking with fear, and he stumbled. The villagers flocked out to see him, lining the way ahead. Looking at their faces, he drew strength from their sympathy.
One more performance, Nuada, he told himself. Surely you have the strength for that.
He was led beyond the main hall, where only the night before he had held the villagers spellbound with tales of heroism and courage. What he would not give now to seek lawgivers and the other knights thundering down the hillside to rescue him. Now there would be a song. They took him to a dead tree in a clearing, and there was the Red Knight, Edrin.
So, he said, the storyteller returns. Where is your sword, Sir Knight, and your helm?
I have no sword, said Nuada.
I will loan you one. Then at least you can fight for your life.
Nuada shook his head.
No.
If I were to kill you, these people would suffer for it. You made a bargain. Me for them. Honor it. He could see the anger in the knight's eyes, and knew that he had won. For if the knight had killed him in combat, the word would have spread through the settlements that the new knights of the Gabala were weaker than the red knights of the king. He smiled.
What now, Sir Knight?
If you are too cowardly to fight, then you will die like a villain.
Soldiers surrounded Nuada, and his armor was unbuckled and pulled from him. Then he was taken to the tree, his arm.